Please be advised, this episode contains detailed discussions of violence and may not be suitable for all listeners.
There's no address listed for Ruth Elizabeth Bettis' death certificate, just a reference to a low water crossing near a ghost town outside of Austin, Texas. Ruth left work at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, November 24, 1982, with a passenger in her car, and was found the next morning behind a patch of cedar trees, shot to death with a .22 caliber weapon. This is the story of a young woman whose whole life was ahead of her. Hello, and welcome to Box in the Basement podcast. I'm your host, Arlene.
And I'm Leah.
In 1996, my world was shattered when my uncle Leon Lorelles was shot execution style in a small town in Texas. To this day, his murder remains unsolved, and the pain of that injustice continues to haunt me, my family, and Leon's friends and co-workers. Here at Box in the Basement, we want to shed light on the overwhelming number of unsolved murders and disappearances here in Texas and beyond. Ultimately, we want to get justice for Leon and for all the victims whose cases are sitting, collecting dust in a box in a basement.
1982 was a violent year, with the Falklands War and the Israeli invasion of Lebanon happening abroad, and the still unsolved Tylenol murders in Chicago spreading terror across the U.S. The personal computer was Time's Man of the Year. The first CD player was sold in Japan. John Belushi died of a drug overdose at age 33, and Epcot opened at Walt Disney World. The L.A. Lakers won the NBA championship. The New York Islanders won the Stanley Cup. The San Francisco 49ers won the Super Bowl, and the St. Louis Cardinals won the World Series. Lionel Richie's Truly topped the Billboard Hot 100 the week of November 24th, followed by Laura Branigan and Olivia Newton-John. T.G. Shepherd's War is Hell was number one on the country charts, followed closely by Ricky Skaggs, Charlie Pride, and Alabama. Space by James Michener sat atop the New York Times bestseller list. And let me tell you, as a history major, both undergrad and at the graduate level, I've been able to make my way through some dry, dense stuff, but I have never been able to finish a Michener book. I've had Texas on my bookshelf for 20 years. The Empire Strikes Back was the number one movie at the box office that week, but E.T. was the top movie of the year, far and above. Bud Light made its debut in 1982, as did Diet Coke, G.I. Joe, the Commodore 64, and Nike Air Force One. It was a big year for pop culture. Austin is the capital of Texas, with a population of just under a million people as of 2021. And that's Austin proper, not including the greater metro area, which consists of almost 2.5 million people today. It's the fourth most populous city in Texas and the 10th most populous city in the U.S. In 1982, when this crime occurred, Austin had around 350,000 people living in the city limits. Pioneers traveling westward across what is now the United States started settling the Austin area along the Colorado River in the 1830s, though Spanish colonists set up missions and settlements in the area a century earlier. Austin, originally known as Waterloo, replaced Houston as the capital of Texas when Texas was still an independent republic, as it was in a location convenient to the trade and travel routes of the day. After Texas became a state in 1845, the city of Austin grew up around the state government entities and the University of Texas. The Texas oil boom largely missed Austin at first, but eventually took hold after the Great Depression. The Public Works Administration enabled the city of Austin to build numerous parks and man-made lakes in and around the city. Today, Austin is a vibrant city that is considered a center of technology and information technology, and the University of Texas at Austin remains one of the most prestigious public universities in the country. Austin is home to Tesla's corporate headquarters, Keller Williams Realty, Indeed, and Yeti. 3M, Apple, Amazon, AMD, Cisco, eBay, Electronic Arts, Facebook, Google, HP, Intel, Nintendo, PayPal, Samsung, and Xerox also have major offices in Austin. If you want a tech job, Austin is a good place to be.
Yeah, we've considered moving to Austin since you'd be able to get a good job there pretty easily. And it's just a cool place. We've spent quite a bit of time there. It's the live music capital of the world.
As much as I'd like to just get in the car and go to live shows on a whim, I think I'd stroke out dealing with that traffic every day. Eesh. Anyway, Austin, like many other major cities in the early 1980s, experienced a wave of violent crime. 1982 was the bloodiest year on record, with 69 homicides landing on the desks of Austin and Travis County law enforcement. Austin proper accounted for 57 of those homicides, which was a 46% increase over 1981. And murder rates had been climbing over the previous years. There are a lot of reasons for this upward trend in violent crime, and we won't get into great detail here. It's just important to understand the context.
Elizabeth Ruth Bettis was born on September 26, 1963, in Austin to Dale and Rebecca Bettis, and had a sister 3 years older than her named Catherine. She went by Elizabeth, at least for most of her short life. Dale Bettis was a naval officer, so the family moved around a lot during Elizabeth's early years. As she and her sister attended schools in England, Switzerland, and throughout the New England, Dale and Rebecca Bettis divorced when Elizabeth was 6 years old, and eventually she ended up earning a scholarship to an expensive prep school in Connecticut, where she was a natural-born artist, excelling in dance, music, and poetry. That all began to fall apart as she progressed through high school, however. Elizabeth began to push back, fighting against comparisons with her older sister and moving to South Carolina to attend college at the age of 16. She eventually transferred to Southwestern University School of Fine Arts in Georgetown, Texas, near Austin, to be closer to her father, who was teaching at the University of Texas at the time. She'd quit school entirely by the spring of 1982. And it's important to note that by this time, Elizabeth started going by the name Gibson with her friends. This was her mother's great-grandfather's name. Just for clarification, in case you do some research on your own, we'll continue to call her Elizabeth, as that's how her family knew her. Elizabeth started dancing and waiting tables at Sugar's, an Austin topless bar, in the summer of 1982, and was making $500 a day in 2024 dollars.
And from what I've read, money was kind of a driving factor in her choices at the time. When her parents got divorced, things were pretty tight, at least for a little while. Even though Elizabeth was the younger sibling, she felt like she kind of had to take on the role of caretaker. Her mother went to work when she was pretty young, but she often had trouble making ends meet. Elizabeth was acutely aware of the disparity between her family's financial status and that of her classmates, being a student at a swanky prep school. Some people might see her working at a topless bar as another act of rebellion, but I honestly think it was mostly a financially driven decision. It wasn't a trashy bar, it was in a decent part of town, and it tended to attract a less sketchy clientele than other strip clubs in Austin. I think she saw an opportunity to make decent money and went after it. But that's just my opinion. Various interviews say Elizabeth wasn't super thrilled about the job, but she did it to pay the bills until she could find a different job. I'm not going to criticize or shame anyone for working at a topless bar regardless. Work is work. Records show that right before her death, she paid off her car and then bought a $1,000 baby grand piano with cash. That's over $3,000 in 2024 money.
19-year-old Elizabeth Bettis was last seen in the parking lot at Sugar's after her shift ended around 7:45 p.m. on Wednesday, November 24th, 1982. The day before Thanksgiving. She was in her light blue 1969 Volkswagen Beetle, arguing with a man standing outside. A witness described the man as being a slender, well-dressed black man, about 30 years old, 6 feet tall, with a closely cropped afro. The man then got into Elizabeth's car with her, and they drove off. About 15 minutes after leaving the bar's parking lot, the blue VW Beetle was seen pulling into a field on a defunct dairy farm at Sprinkle Cutoff in northeast Travis County. This is about 7 miles from Sugar's. Elizabeth Bettis' body was discovered on Thanksgiving Day in the tall grass of that field on the old dairy farm. Her car was about 100 yards away. She had been strangled, sexually assaulted, beaten, and shot above the right eye with a .22 caliber handgun. The medical examiner put her time of death somewhere between 10 p.m. and midnight the night before.
Investigators didn't find any evidence in her car, which led them to believe that she'd been attacked where she'd been found. However, as we'll find out later in our discussion, one of the suspects in Elizabeth's death was an Austin police officer, so someone cleaning the car and removing evidence is not completely out of the question. Some of the older articles I've read covering the case say there wasn't any evidence found at the scene either. But we have to keep in mind that it was a cold, rainy, wet day, and this was 1982. Trace evidence was an entirely different animal.
Unlike many of the other cases we've covered so far, police actually had several good suspects for this murder. Good enough that their identities were made public.
Yeah, this is kind of a nice change from a research perspective. I have a little more to work with. First, we have a guy named Leonard Williams. He was a 29-year-old maintenance worker for the city water and wastewater department, and he turned out to be a serial rapist who would force his victims to drive out to the very same area where Elizabeth Bettis' body was found. It sounds like a good fit in theory, but Williams didn't match the description of the man last seen with Elizabeth. Also, Williams abducted his victims at knife point and let them all live. While it's not unreasonable to believe that he'd escalate to murder eventually, the lack of stab wounds or slash marks led investigators to conclude that Williams wasn't their guy. It was simply too big of a stretch.
Next, we have Louis Sonny Juan, who has a really weird connection to Elizabeth Bettis. First of all, he was the son-in-law of the owners of the old dairy farm where her body was discovered and was on the property the day her body was found. To fully understand why he was considered a suspect, we have to go on a little tangent here and talk about another Austin area murder, that of Deborah Baker in Georgetown in 1988. A guy named Mark Norwood went on trial for that murder, and people close to the case were afraid that this legal team would bring up Elizabeth Bettis' murder and implicate Sonny Juan in both killings. Norwood and Juan knew each other and worked together at one point, and Juan's own ex-wife and daughter spoke negatively about Juan during the Norwood trial. Juan was well known to local law enforcement. He had a substantial rap sheet and was generally not held in high regard.
So was he just a convenient distraction for the defense in the other trial, you think? Elizabeth's body being found on his in-law's property while he was there, though, that's a pretty wild coincidence.
Yeah, and he knew Elizabeth Bettis, at least in passing. He was a customer at her grandfather's appliance shop, so he knew who she was. But, and this is a big but, it's important to note that by the time Norwood went on trial for Deborah Baker's murder, Sonny Juan was dead. So my gut is telling me that he was a distraction. Pin it on the dead guy with a rap sheet who can't defend himself. And about the location of Elizabeth's body? In this particular scenario, I think it was a coincidence. As much as I hate coincidences, but remember that the serial rapist you mentioned preferred to take his victims to that area, so it's possible this was a copycat, or an attempted copycat. And I don't know, but maybe it was a popular place for illegal activity in general. It's pretty out of the way.
Finally, as far as official suspects who have been made public go, investigators liked two Austin Police Department officers for the murder. These two men were seen sitting with Elizabeth at the bar that night, and one of them was seen leaving the bar with her, with the second cop following just a few minutes later. What bothers me here is the fact that these two cops covered up the fact that they'd been with Elizabeth Bettis that night. They were only found out 6 years after the fact during a DEA investigation. By that time, one of the cops had already left the department after an unrelated internal investigation, and the other cop was never charged. If there was any link to her murder, it wasn't strong enough to bring a case against him.
The biggest thing that made investigators believe a cop might be involved was the lack of evidence at the scene and in the Volkswagen. A cop would have knowledge of evidence collection and crime scene processing, so it's not an unreasonable assumption.
Right, that's possible. I think if a cop was involved, though, it had something more to do with drugs. We haven't mentioned it yet, but Elizabeth Bettis was known to use cocaine on occasion. This was the early 1980s after all. Her tox screen postmortem showed that she'd used cocaine the night she was killed. One article I read speculated that maybe this would be a more believable reason Elizabeth would have been murdered by a cop, especially if these two cops were shady. Maybe she was collateral damage in an attempt to cover up using or moving coke. It doesn't really matter at this point what I think, though, because nobody has ever been charged, and this case has been sitting cold for decades.
If it wasn't any of those four suspects, then who killed her? She was a bit of a free spirit, at least in her private life, but she didn't seem to have any real enemies. She lived in a house with another couple, played the piano during her free time, and she worked the day shift at a topless bar.
So several interviews I read with acquaintances said she was extremely trusting and believed the best of people. And I don't want anyone to take this as me victim shaming. I'm absolutely not doing that. A coworker of hers at the bar said she had a tendency to do things other people wouldn't do because she just trusted people. Her roommate also told a story in an interview about how she witnessed Elizabeth lead a guy on in order to get cocaine, and this actually scared the roommate. It's possible Elizabeth simply got tangled up with the wrong drug slinger and couldn't talk her way out of a bad situation.
That's kind of what I was thinking. The guy she was seen arguing with in the parking lot at the bar is the last person known to be with her. It's reasonable to believe this is the guy that killed her. But who was he? Was he a boyfriend? Or someone Elizabeth was getting drugs from? Nobody seems to know. He wasn't either one of the cops she'd been in the bar with just a little while earlier. We know that much. Elizabeth's roommate did say in an interview, and I quote, "I think if someone offered her something she wanted, like cocaine, and she always wanted it, she would have gone with them," end quote. So that kind of makes me lean towards your theory that it was something to do with drugs. She just found herself in a bad situation with a bad guy.
It's been over 41 years since Ruth Elizabeth Bettis was murdered outside of Austin, Texas. If you have any information regarding her case, please contact the Travis County Sheriff's Office tip line at 512-854-1444 or Crime Stoppers at 512-472-8477. You can also submit a tip through the Travis County Sheriff's Office website or email the Cold Case Unit at coldcase@traviscountytx.gov.
This podcast has a bigger purpose than just providing information and entertainment. The Homicide Victims' Families' Rights Act is a bipartisan bill that was signed into law by Congress in 2021, and we want to see it put into action. This law establishes a systematic process for reviewing case files related to cold case murders. The focus is on providing a mechanism for the families and friends of murder victims to request a formal review of such cases. We need an attorney or teams of attorneys and legal professionals to take on the bold and brave fight against the system around the country. In our case, we need someone to fight for Leon to help not only put fresh eyes on the case, but to get his body exhumed to search for evidence that was not collected the first time around. We and other families and friends need assistance with getting FOIA requests. It blows our minds that so many murders occurred from 1976 to 1997 in Brownwood, Texas, under the watch of the same investigators responsible for for handling Leon's case. We're going to look at all the unsolved murders in Brownwood, and maybe even a few solved ones if it helps uncover what was happening in that era that left so many families devastated and a community living in fear. If you want to hear more about victim-focused unsolved cases and get updates about what we know, please subscribe, like, and share our podcast. Also, visit our website, justiceforleon.com, to donate to our cause to hire an attorney. You can also join our email list to stay current on developments on Leon's case and other cases we cover as they happen. Please follow and like our Facebook pages for Box in the Basement and Justice for Leon Laurelis, and follow our Instagram pages. I'd also like to ask that you sign my petition for my Uncle Leon Laurelis' case to be reopened and reviewed with fresh eyes, and you can find our petition on change.org. I also have a GoFundMe page to hire an attorney to help me get a copy of his autopsy that I have been denied for 27 years. You can find the GoFundMe by searching for Leon Laurelis. That's L-A-U-R-E-L-E-S. Thank you for joining us. Be kind. Later, Gators.